Thank you. And 064316, United States versus Yusef Pira. Mr. Hunter, I can finally say good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Judge. Good afternoon, Your Honors, Counsel. Judge, in this case, Joe Pira, his name's Yusef, but I always knew him as Joe, he was before Judge Anderson, and Judge Anderson heard a great deal of evidence to show that he was basically a career flim-flam man. And what Judge Anderson then did, in his own words, is he lumped together a group of frauds. Judge Anderson, in his reasoning, said that he concluded that Joe Pira was committing every fraud he could think up over a period of years, and so the judge lumped them together, saying that they were all relevant conduct. But that was a mistake on his part. And we'd ask you to remand for resentencing, because the offenses that he pled guilty to, that Pira pled guilty to, were not closely related or really related at all to the offenses that were deemed relevant conduct. And I'd like to focus, if I may, on the million-dollar check, because under the guidelines, if I don't win on the million-dollar check, everything else more or less becomes moot. Some of the reasons why the million-dollar check is not related to the offenses that Joe Pira pled guilty to include that there was no temporal proximity. Joe Pira had an image of a check on his computer, and there was no evidence as to when or how long it had been on there, but it certainly in time didn't correspond to the offenses he pled guilty to.
Well, are you kind of viewing it like this was his artwork?
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's his artwork. I think that Joe wanted to show off what a genius he was and say, look at me, I can make a $1 million check on a computer. But I don't think that there was any evidence, and in fact there was evidence to the contrary, that that check was ever printed or negotiated.
But the district court found as a fact that he was planning on doing that, that it wasn't a joke, it wasn't artwork, that he was waiting for the proper moment to do that. And so it was, in that sense, part of the offense conduct.
Well, if that is what Judge Anderson found, and I guess I would take issue with that conclusion, he said that it was possible. I believe he found that that was more of an intended loss rather than an actual loss situation, that he may have slowly built up a trust of a victim by negotiating legitimate checks, and then finally show up one day with a $1 million check, which was the scenario in the criminal case where Joe Pira actually worked for the Secret Service and set up a would-be criminal who negotiated a large check on that basis. But I believe that the notion that the $1 million check was related was not that he was someday going to negotiate it, but rather that was a possibility and therefore an intended loss. That I would agree, I would concede that Joe did have the court found that Joe did have the check on his computer mm-hmm. with the intent to negotiate it. But even if that's true, it doesn't mean it's related to and therefore relevant conduct to the offenses he pled guilty to. One of the arguments made was that Joe Pira was engaged in a credit card scheme and that he used fake checks to pay off the balances of the credit card and therefore acquire fraudulently greater credit. But if you look at page 47 of the transcript, what Agent Bush actually said is that that's possibly what happened. He was merely speculating. However, Judge Anderson, I believe, relied on that when he concluded that, in fact, it was relevant conduct. And I find that to be a unwarranted conclusion, in part because nobody's going to pay off a credit card bill with a $1 million check.
No, but you might put a $1 million check in some bank account somewhere, and then, I mean, it looked like all of these things, or at least the district judge seemed to think all of this was quite interrelated, that the credit cards were being paid with phony checks, and that then lines of credit would be extended, and then more charges would be made, and the banking side of this and the credit card side of this were actually quite interrelated.
Well, he did conclude that, but he was wrong because, again, getting back to what Agent Bush said possibly he paid it off with a fraudulent check, but at the same time, on page 47 of the transcript, Agent Bush said possibly he used a phony credit card to pay off another phony credit
card.
But
isn't it plausible to view all of these fraudulent checks as part of the same ongoing series of frauds as the credit cards? Because the checks had the same goal as the credit cards, which is defrauding financial institutions. So don't A and B equal C here?
No, Judge, because first, to say financial institutions generally I don't believe is enough. You have to have a same victim, and the victim would be like, you know, Fifth Third Bank, not just banks generally. And second, to say that the goal was the same, the goal of every financial crime is to obtain money for the criminal. And if we're going to apply that broad a net, then everything's related to everything else. And that is the kind of reasoning that was used here, because one of the other things that Judge Anderson relied on was the fact that a computer was used. But in this day and age, saying that a computer was used is like saying a pen was used. Everybody uses a computer for a variety of things. There was nothing special about the computer in relation to any of these crimes. You know, he apparently plugged in his encoding device so that he could boost the limits on credit cards. And then he apparently created the image of $1 million check on the computer. But those, aside from the fact that the same computer was used, those are totally unrelated. They're different steps that you take. And a computer was just a tool. But the tool itself couldn't connect those two crimes.
I thought the guidelines actually thought the computers are particularly troublesome tools, since they can create such perfect replicas of legitimate documents and the like.
Well, perhaps, but I don't think that the guidelines are concluding that if you use a computer in two separate crimes that they are automatically related.
Maybe not automatically, but that wasn't the only relation that existed here. It was the interdependence of the schemes, the credit card and the banking schemes.
Well, I don't really think there was interdependence because, again, getting back to the $1 million check, the evidence is that it was never negotiated. The government tries to imply in their brief that it was because Joe made a statement about two checks being printed off his computer, but those were two different checks. In addition, there's no evidence in the record to show that those checks were ever used beyond the Agent Bush speculation I mentioned earlier. There's no evidence to suggest that those checks were ever used to pay off the credit.
You know, those two checks, I'm trying to find here. How much were they for?
$54,000, and I can't remember the exact amounts, far less than $1 million. Judge, I see I'm starting to run out of time, and there's one other point aside from the relevant conduct that I wanted to touch on, and that is this, that I think that the judge also erred because the first thing he did when he calculated the sentence was he went through the guidelines calculation, and I believe that it's reasonable to conclude from that he was presuming that the guidelines were reasonable, and that was his starting point. And I would submit that in light of recent U.S. opinion in U.S. versus Rita, that is improper. Rita said that a appellate court may presume that the guidelines reasonable, but since it didn't create such a presumption for district courts, I don't think that would be proper. In addition, all eight justices who affirmed Rita's sentence agreed that the guideline sentence may not properly reflect the 3553A purposes and factors. The guidelines might reflect unsound judgment, and the guidelines might not treat individual characteristics properly. And I think that that's what happened here. There was such a huge disparity between the intended loss and the amount of loss, and I think that Judge Anderson recognized that to the extent that he was willing to go down to the bottom of the guidelines range, but because he was presuming the guidelines reasonable, he wouldn't go below that.
I did find it. One was $54,000, and the other one was $4,800, the other check.
I see I'm out of
Thank
time.
Thank you.
I would just ask the court to consider remanding this for resentencing.
You still have time for a minute rebuttal, Mr. Young.
May it please the court. The defendant was engaged in an unrelenting course of criminal behavior that involved the utilization of stolen and counterfeit credit cards and stolen and counterfeit checks.
You know, no question, no question. This is that kind of a guy. But the $1 million check, it really does seem to be in a category by itself relative to the usual sorts of fraudulent transactions he's engaged in. What does the record tell us about that check and whether he had ever attempted to perpetrate a comparable fraud?
Your Honor,
I see him building up. You know, I see credit cards up to $350,000. I see, you know, $225,000. But the checks.
Your Honor, on the date of the search of his apartment where all these items were recovered, an interview was conducted by an agent of the Secret Service, Agent Bush. And during that interview, Mr. Pryor told Agent Bush that they would find two checks on his computers, a Bank One check and a TCF bank check, counterfeit checks that he had prepared and that he had sent to individuals who he identified as Ahmad and Mike. When that computer was searched by forensic experts at the Secret Service, they actually found three checks, the $1 million check, which was from Bank One, and two other checks that were from TCF. As I think I noted, he said one from Bank One, one from TCF. There were actually two from TCF. But there was only that $1 million check from Bank One, a check that he said, and he had said that he had sent a Bank One check to Ahmad H. and Mike, and he didn't know if they had been cashed. That's the evidence that had actually been sent, Your Honor. An inference has to be drawn, obviously, but I think it's a reasonable inference that could be drawn from that evidence. Beyond that, I think it's unimaginable that someone like Yusef Pira would prepare such an instrument when considered against all the other evidence in the record for fun or without some intent to cash the check. Is it unlikely that he could succeed or one of his runners could succeed? Perhaps it is. I'd like to believe that someone attempting to cash a $1 million check would receive great scrutiny. But nevertheless, the possibility of success is not a factor under the guidelines. Even an act that can never achieve success, such as a controlled buy or something along those lines, counts towards intended loss, and it should here. I'd also like to address the idea of temporal proximity. Counsel said that there was no evidence whatsoever about when this check was prepared, and that's simply incorrect. First of all, the check itself was dated November 12th of 2002, only 10 days before the date of the search. Secondly, the defendant, when he testified at the sentencing hearing, acknowledged that he prepared that check during the same month of the search. So there's very strong evidence of temporal proximity, that he had prepared that check within a matter of days, no more than 30, of the date of the search, which was also the date of the offense of which he ultimately pled guilty to. It was also reasonable, and that really goes to the temporal proximity, the similarity as well, I think, in terms of the offenses, the credit card, the checks. In either event, he's stealing information, be it account information or bank information, creating fraudulent instruments, and using it to defraud financial institutions. So there's temporal proximity, there's similarity, and I think there's regularity, as demonstrated by the mass amount of instruments that were found in his apartment. And that simply goes to whether or not it's the same course of conduct. The court also concluded that it was part of a common scheme and plan. And again, you have a similar purpose to defraud financial institutions through the use of the stolen information and fraudulent instruments. You also have a common modus operandi. And I think in this regard, it goes to more simply than he used a computer. He was the person who would manufacture these items, be it credit card or be it check. He would obtain the information, and then he would be the one who would manufacture the checks on his computer or re-encode the credit cards. There are also blank credit cards that he would manufacture as well. And then he would use someone else to do the running. Zach Costinos testified. But also, even with respect to the checks, in his statement he said that he didn't attempt to cash them. He attempted to use someone else to cash them. So I think there's also a great deal of similarity in terms of the modus operandi that allowed Judge Anderson to conclude that not only the checks fraud was part of a common course of conduct, but also part of a common scheme or plan. For those reasons, the government would ask that the sentence of Judge Anderson be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Mr. Hunter?
Judge, responding to the modus operandi argument, yes, he manufactured the check and he manufactured the credit cards. But the standard is that they have to be strongly related, and that's like saying he committed two separate crimes, but he was the guy who committed them. I just don't see how that can make a relationship. With respect to the argument that there were runners, the whole idea that he used runners came from Zachary Castino's. Zachary Castino's testimony, as I outlined in my brief, was just horrible. I felt uncomfortable crossing him because he was this burned-out alcoholic who couldn't give you a straight answer. And you know what? He didn't really say that. He didn't testify to that. Mr. Young testified to it on a leading question, and then Mr. Castino said yes. But if you ever asked him an open-ended question, you got an answer that left you scratching your head because it didn't make any sense. He also said things that were physically impossible. And in the government's brief, they say, well, if you don't want to believe him, he has to say things that are physically impossible. He did. He said that he was in Illinois with Pyra. Then he said he was in California in rehab. He said that he never told the agents about the accomplices because I was saying, well, who are these guys? What are their names? Did you tell the agents about them? And he said, nope, never told the agents about them. So then I showed him his plea agreement and said, aren't you required to tell them? And he goes, well, I did tell them. He said two logically opposite things, and he concluded, I see I'm out of time. I would just ask you to remand this for resentencing and ask the court to consider applying proper law. Thank you.
And the court wants to thank you for taking this case as an appointed attorney and doing quite a job for Mr. Pura. And thank you, U.S. Attorney's Office, as always.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement. Court is in.